Right. Welcome, everyone. I will go around and greet each of our 26 participants. Well, 27, because there's two people on one. Say hi to Joshin, So-on, Tyler, Jinryu, Paulette, Bob K, Vin, Marvin, Sam, Pat, Mark, W, I think you're the only Mark, Mark W, Amelia, Susan, Diane, Jim, Matt, Dawn, and Christopher, Choketsu, Bruce, Jessica, Coral, Cinda, Linda, Sabrina, and Ruth Ann. So welcome, everyone. I can't think of any announcements. Anybody else? Oh, and Ozma with Pat. anybody have any announcements that we should be making, upcoming groups or anything like that?
I think Mark said that the retreat, the all-day retreat, is that the 22nd of August? I was going to put it in my calendar.
Yes, yes, indeed. Thank you, because that's not too far away, is it?
No.
Yeah, so we were going to have an in-person retreat on Saturday, August 22nd, but we'll do an online one instead. And I asked Lisa, our admin assistant, to update that to look like our last online retreat. So I don't know. I haven't even seen it, but I think it should have been updated or will be to show the same kind of, you know, at home participatory one day retreat thing.
Cool. So
thanks for reminding me of that. Tuesdays we're continuing with our Uchiyama Roshi's How to Cook Your Life from Zen Kitchen to Enlightenment. Let's see. And other than that, well, it's somebody did ask me today, and I guess I'll just repeat that, you know, when are we going to be meeting in person? You're probably not surprised to know that we just don't know. You know, our board and senior students did meet and talk about that, and essentially, we all just want to err on the side of caution, and it really does seem like in-person group, extended group meetings, as we do at our Zendo, was going to be one of the last things that become safe to do. So we are committed to further developing our online presence, getting more creative in those arenas. There's actually some neat things that you can do. Like somebody pointed out, you don't really have to have people print out the chants ahead of time. I mean, that's cool, but I could just put a link in the chat that you can go to the website and you can pull up the chant and you can look through it. Or we could even share a screen and somebody could be scrolling through it. So which means that we could switch up, you know, we've been doing service, chanting service A on Sundays since this happened. And now we could start switching off with service B, where we chant the line of women ancestors. So anyway, there's just, you know, and if you can, any of you also think of things that you want to add or, you know, there's several different groups that are meeting now. If anybody wants to organize and host a safe, socially distanced gathering somewhere, please please step forward and volunteer, and I'm sure you'll get some help. So Let's see. So I want to introduce our guest speaker and teacher today, Joshin, who is a priest at Dharmarine Zen Center and also one of the co-teachers out at YE Zen Center in Sandy. And so many of you know her because Y East and Brightway do our week-long annual session together, which amazingly we were going to do, we would ordinarily have done our in-person collaborative session in August or September. And we had decided, because we had to switch venue, that we would, that we couldn't do that this year, so we scheduled it for March, because we're using a different place, which ends up being actually kind of advantageous because we would have had to cancel it anyway, given COVID. So once we start doing in-person session again, we do it collaboratively with Y East. And so some of you have been there when Joshin and Shintai and I have co-led the session. You may know her that way. And Joshin and I were friends before ordination, and we know each other from Dharmarine and practiced side by side for quite a long time. So it's just, we probably would have totally cracked us up if, say, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we had said, you know what, I'm going to have my own Zen Center over here, and then like I could invite you, and you can give a Dharma talk. We'd be like, you know. But here we are. So it is a delight to have you here, Joshin. And go ahead and let me know if you want any tech support or breakout rooms or anything like that.
Thank you, Domio. One thing I would ask for is, no matter how big or small I make my Zoom screen, I can't see everybody. So when we get to the questions, if you could just help that move along, that would be great. Thanks. So I want to thank Domio for that introduction. I totally would have cracked up if 10 years ago somebody would have said, I'm going to go give a talk at Domio Zen Center. Yeah, but life is amazing and we never know where things are going to take us. So let that be a warning to you. So the talk for today, I've titled it Many Kinds of Giving. And I knew this talk was coming up. It was on my schedule, giving a talk at Brightway. And as is sometimes common for me, when it came time to put a talk together, I was like, what should I talk about? And so I asked around residents here and what's up for people? What might be interesting? What might people want to know about? And one of the things that came up was just this sense of so much is changing, so much is uncertain. Like, how do we deal with that? Like, how do we deal with that from a practice perspective? And so this is coming from that place. And specifically, this was asked by a woman with two teenage children who's looking at this uncertainty around what's going to happen with school in the fall. Are the kids going to go back to school? Are they going to be at home? How does she plan for this? Things have to be figured out in a matter of weeks and nothing's decided yet. And so there's a lot of uncertainty around that. So that's, you know, a difficulty that's stemming from this pandemic, which creates its own uncertainty. And also we have a lot of social unrest coming from racism and abuse of power by various law enforcement agencies. We have protests happening within the city. We also have climate change, which is creating a great deal of uncertainty. Looking at the news and noticing the really wild, dramatic changes in temperatures in the Arctic and melting of sea ice and permafrost. There's just a lot of, I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, the big joke online is that 2020 is this year that just keeps throwing stuff at us. Something new every time we turn around. So with that, and with this question of how do we meet these conditions? How do we meet these constant changes? Not just how do we meet change, but how do we meet these exhausting constant changes? When I sat with that, one of the things that arose was just this very simple aspect of giving. And so in Buddhism, when we talk about giving, we often talk about dana. That may be a word that's familiar to many of you. Dana is the act of giving. Oftentimes we use it as a noun. I'm going to give dana to a teacher for a retreat. But dana is actually the act of giving. It's that instance of giving. And there's also a word in Pali called kaga, and that's generosity, and that's more of the quality of mind. So we have dana, the act, and kaga, the mental quality. And then we have the thing itself, which is given. So I'm going to toss several lists at you. You don't have to remember these. If something sticks in your head, great. You can ask questions about them later. I've got them in my notes. But in looking at these teachings of giving from the Pali Canon, there are several things that arise. One is that there are three kinds of giving that we often talk about. There's the giving of material things like food, shelter, money, gifts, tangible things. There's the giving of fearlessness. So this is the giving of protection to beings when they've become frightened on account of worldly conditions, giving reassurance. And then there's the giving of dharma. And it said that the giving of dharma is the highest gift. Now also in the Pali Canon, there's a list of 8 reasons for giving. Why might we engage in these acts of dana? These acts of giving. And it's said that we give from desire, we give from hatred, we give from delusion. So those are the three poisons. So giving from negative aspects of behavior, we give from fear. We give thinking, this was practiced before by my father and forefathers. I should not abandon this ancient family custom. So because we've done it before, because my family has done it before, we continue to give. We might give thinking, having given this gift with the breakup of the body after death, I will be reborn in a good destination in the heavenly world. So this is giving out of a sense of attaining a higher rebirth afterwards. And we might give from thinking, when I'm giving this gift, my mind becomes placid and elation and joy arise. So giving to get a calm mental state. And then the last one is giving for ornamenting the mind or equipping the mind. This giving as practice. And this last list I'm going to mention, the 5 gifts of a superior person. And superior being sort of a label for people of practice, or people who have had attainments in practice. And this practitioner gives a gift out of faith, gives a gift respectfully, gives a gift at the right time, gives a gift with a generous heart, and gives a gift without denigration. And I think those last two really stand out for me, just giving a gift with a generous heart and giving a gift without denigration. Without having that sense that we're better than somebody else, so we're going to give to the unfortunate. So that brings up a sense of just recognizing the simple humanness of those we're giving to. So in Buddhism, there's a great emphasis on giving. And in the Mahayana tradition, Dana Paramita, this perfection of giving, is the first of the perfections. And these perfections are a set of six or a set of 10 that are put forth as qualities of moral and ethical value, these qualities to turn towards. And this Dana Paramita, this perfection of giving, is both a starting place and it's a foundation for practicing the other paramitas. So that's the act of the giving itself. And in terms of this distinguishing between dana and kaga, kaga can be cultivated with something like metta practice, if you're familiar with that, or tonglen from the Tibetan traditions. This mental quality of cultivating generosity can be undertaken in meditation. It's a preparing for an act of dana. Part of why this is emphasized is that it's taught to show a lack of separation from self and other, and to help cultivate a sense of compassion or empathy, to create strong, positive social bonds. And it's also taught for its own sake, in the manner that Zazen is taught for its own sake, not as needing something more or leading to a particular place. I've noticed for me, for myself, in my own life, in my own practice, I've spent a lot of time recently watching the protests that have been happening downtown in Portland. I've had a desire to go down there, and my post-cancer body just keeps saying, mm-mm. So I've had to refrain from that, but I watch online, I watch the live streams, I watch things that show up on social media, and I'm struck again and again at the remarkable acts I see of giving and of generosity at those protests. See the tent set up for Riot Ribs, this organization or this group of people who are cooking food for protesters, for passerbys, for anybody who wants a meal. They're making a meal and sharing a meal. And they've received that food through donations of funds, through donations of food supplies. I saw them put out a call for tables, and within an hour they had many more tables show up. I've seen people being injured and those around stopping to help. So many times I hear, are you okay? Do you need something? Can we get you a medic? Where are the medics? These calls for the medics. I see people taking care of each other, even as they are engaging in acts that call for taking care of others. Going back to this question of uncertainty, of chronic uncertainty, of life throwing things at us again and again, I want to point out the importance of spiritual stability and resiliency as ways to meet these challenges, and the importance of motivation as we turn towards how to meet these challenges. So our motivation and our intention and our view contributes a lot to how we are meeting a moment. And so with looking at, here's chronic uncertainty, and here is teachings of generosity or giving, it's not necessarily, I'm not talking about a one-to-one antidote, as if here's a moment of uncertainty, and I'm going to meet it with a gift, and therefore it's going to eliminate that uncertainty. It's not working quite that way, but more synergistically, in that when the mind can't hold two things at the same time. So when anxiety arises, it's possible to take an action that encompasses an entirely different mind state. So that we learn again and again to cultivate that more generous, more pleasant, more practice-oriented mind state. And in the Zen tradition, we start practice with the physical component. I'm guessing when you came to practice Zen and you learned meditation, when you learned Zazen, what you weren't taught first was, here's a list of things to believe, here's doctrine, here's philosophy. Instead, most often we're taught, here's how you sit. Here's what you do with the body. And there's trust in that when you do something with the body, as the body learns that, understanding arises. So we sit in Zazen, we teach our body to be still, we teach our body to sit in a way that we're stable, and then through that, an understanding of practice arises. And we can do this with giving as well. We can do this with generosity as well. In that, when we give a gift, we notice how that feels. And that action of giving a gift sets up the mind for being willing to give another gift at a later time. And so what am I talking about in terms of gift here? So going back to those three types of giving, gift of material things, gift of fearlessness, and gift of Dharma. We can certainly give material things. These are the simplest, sometimes easiest type to give. Food, clothing, shelter, water, funds, tangibles, books, sofas. I'm getting ready to move, so I've got furniture on my mind. Things. And we can give fearlessness, reassurance, comfort, acknowledgement. Think for a moment of a point in time where you felt like you were seen by someone, that you were truly seen by someone. That's a gift they gave you, is that attention and that presence and that that being there for you. We can do this for others. That's one of the gifts of fearlessness, that just capacity to be present for another person, to let them know that you're there, to let them know that they're not alone. Because part of what happens when we're caught in worry or anxiety about something we can't control is that there's an internal constriction. There's an internal pulling in and wanting to defend against that unknown. And that can be isolating. So one way to meet that isolation is this gift of presence, this gift of attention, this gift of reassurance. And not reassurance as a cliche, oh, everything will be fine. But more of a, wow, that's got to be hard for you. That sounds so tough. Empathy, connection. Even if you're not a meditation teacher, you can sit down next to someone and say, let's just breathe together for a moment. And the body relaxes. It might be there's a leaning in or a leaning towards. This is the gift of fearlessness. And oftentimes when we meet these lists in Buddhism, whether we're working with the Pali Canon or the Mahayana Sutras, and we get a list like to give a gift of material things, to give a gift of fearlessness, and to give a gift of the Dharma, we automatically go to, the gift of the Dharma is the highest gift, therefore that's what I got to aim for, and all the rest of the stuff is just like, that's for other people to do. I'm aiming for the Dharma. But the thing is, they're all beneficial. They all create merit. If you're in a situation and you can give a gift of material things, give a gift of material things. It's not a less than. It's not a, I'm not enlightened, so I can only do. It's a gift. And in our, I think it's in our meal chants, there's a reference to the three wheels are pure and clear, giver, receiver, and gift. When we give a gift, we create an opportunity for someone else to receive. And when someone gives us a gift, we're given the opportunity to receive. And sometimes that part, the receiving, can be a hard thing because we have so much conditioning around, oh, no, thanks, but no thanks. I've got it. I'm fine. It's something that we have to learn to really say thank you and to accept that gift. Knowing full well that it is completely empty, that in another moment, we might be the one giving a gift, making a donation, offering comfort. When we have something to give, when we do give, when we have something to give, there is something internal that we might not be aware of that says, by giving something, I have something to give. I have something. I have something of value. And when we become attuned to that sense of I have something, it creates a sense of abundance instead of a sense of lack. It's said in the sutras that even if you give a blade of grass, even if a small child, I think there was something in your echo, a small child building something out of sand, making an offering out of something very mundane and common. It's the giving, it's the noticing the abundance, it's the making an offering that changes perspective, changes view. I give to you, you give to me, we then give to someone else, we then receive something. That's the emptiness of the giving. It's just that it's a flow. It's a dance. It's fluid. Life throws things at us. We receive it. We give something in return that is hopefully beneficial. And I think if there's anything that I want to share this morning, it's that sense that we can all give something. We don't have to compare or compete with value. Oh, this thing I gave is better than this thing that they gave. We all have something we can contribute. We all have something that will connect in that act of giving. So we can cultivate kagga. We can commit acts of dana. And it is through giving that we can recognize abundance and freedom. And when we're in that place of abundance and freedom, those chronic uncertainties aren't as bothersome. They're still there. I'm not saying giving will make them go away, but there's an inner stability that arises out of that sense that we have agency. We can do something. So often life throws us for a loop and we think, what can we do? I can't do anything. It's too big. When I think of climate change, it's too big. I'm just one person. I can do something. I can give something. I can give my effort. And even something small changes conditions. And nobody knows how those changes ripple out. We can never know. But we can do something. So sort of to come back, or to if I were to summarize this, you know, this question really comes down to what is dependable in the midst of uncertainty? What is it that we can rely on? And what we need to know to meet that question is, what are our spiritual resources? How are they accessed? And then now what we're left with is the necessity of self-discernment, of looking inside and getting a sense of, what is it that I can give in this moment? What does this moment need? And then through meditation, we can strengthen our ability to attune to connection and relationship, to attune to what might be needed in the moment, what those that we're spending time with might need. Whether it's a cookie or a moment of empathy or bail funds, we can all give something. So the talk is a little bit short, but I wanted to leave time for questions and answers and comments. So I'm happy to hear from you.
And usually our group is small enough, I just invite people to unmute themselves and speak.
It's so nice to see you, Joshine. So nice to see you. Yes, and I was at Dharma Rain many, many years ago when you had hair.
Yeah.
And a lot of it. Yeah. Well, you know, here we are. We can see each other's faces and we can smile at each other. And I actually played a gig for the first time. I actually got to play some music outside.
Nice.
But there was a woman with a little girl walking by. And usually when children see people playing music, they look a little confused, and I can smile at them. But I was wearing a mask.
Mm.
And so she just looked really disturbed, this child. And so I popped my, you know, stopped playing for a second. I popped my mask off and I smiled at her, which is what I usually do outdoors. There's always children at these shows. And I smile at them and it changes them. It really does. And she, her face just totally relaxed after she saw my face. And so it's hard now, because that's something I've always kept in mind at a grocery store or wherever. If I see a Muslim woman or someone who's obvious, probably doesn't get a lot of smiles, homeless person, an angry person, and just smile at them. And that's a simple gift that we can give each other that right now we can't give. And it's, you know, it's tough. It's tough on the giver.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah. I think I'm a big fan of sci-fi. Like, I've been a sci-fi nerd for most of my life. And one of the things I ran across in reading sci-fi novels recently was they were describing people who grew up in space and how they shrug with their hands instead of their shoulders, because you can see the hands in a spacesuit, easier than you can see shoulders, so we need new things that convey a smile other than just stretching our face. And among Buddhists, we can put our hands together. That's usually some sign of recognition. But we need something out in the conventional world, the secular world, that sort of brings up that here's a symbol that causes connection or indicates connection or goodwill. And maybe it's a head nod, maybe it's something else. But when our mouths are covered, we need something. I like that habit of just whipping off the mask and giving a smile and seeing that they're okay and then putting it right back on. And I appreciate the comments about smiling at Muslim women or other people who maybe don't get so many smiles. Like, that amount of just simple acknowledgement and support can go a long way.
This is Amelia. Thank you so much for your talk. I've really been giving a lot of consideration lately to the concept of reparations, which has been a topic of widespread conversation. And I always thought, my family on my mother's side came from Mississippi, Louisiana, and my great-grandfather was actually a slave owner. And my grandfather was born 20 years after the Civil War. And that's always been just such a source of just, well, shame for me and conflict. And I had always thought, well, my grandfather didn't really inherit anything. There was, you know, his father died when he was young and he really sort of had to make his own way in the world and went to West Point and became a military officer and did well that way. But I realized, you know, after reading the Ta-Nehisi article about reparations that we did in the Awakening to Whiteness workshop, you realize it's not that I didn't inherit money and our family became rich because of slavery. It's how we are positioned in the world, mm-hmm. among other things. I mean, among many other things. But my grandfather had connections as a child, even as a child. We had relatives, prominent, you know, people who were prominent in the community who could help him get into a good grade school and help him get into West Point and help position him. And we've all benefited from that, and my family in some way or another. But I had thought about, well, reparations, I had thought about it in a more of a general term. I've always given to things like the Historically Black College Funds or the NAACP or Black Lives Matter, things that are kind of more general. But it really occurred to me that I needed to, try to make reparations to the people who might have been affected by my family in particular. Mm. And I think it's too hard to find, there are plenty of African Americans with my family's last name in the South. And I think it just is too impractical to try to find individuals, but the communities that they lived in, that my family lived in Mississippi, I can give to those communities, and especially to Black efforts, you know, efforts for the Black community in those communities. And that's what I've been trying to do with my giving right now. It's very focused on that. And it also became clear to me, I thought, well, should I say this is a reparations for the, you know, the Cutrer family? And I just realized it needs to be anonymous. For my own personal, sense of it is that it should be an anonymous gift. And if I want to say this is, you know, because of my family or for whatever reason, but not, it's not to take credit for anything that well, I've become, I figured this one out, but so that is where my effort is going right now. And there's something that just feels really, really right about it. And so I just appreciate everything that you said this morning about, you know, the context that I can put it in terms of my practice as well. So, yeah, thank you.
Yeah. I think there one of the biggest gifts you can give is your respect to those people. Because I can imagine, like, what is it to grow up in a culture that doesn't respect you? The greatest gift you can give there is respect. And I'm glad you're making the efforts towards that. I think, you know, in one sense, it's a beautiful thing to see, and in another sense, it can never be enough. And I think that's something that white people as a whole need to hold, is that sense that it will never be enough.
Thank you so much for your talk. It's been lovely. I had a question on what does, like, I've gotten a lot of what you're talking about. What does giving the gift of the Dharma look like? Like, for myself, I'm very new to this whole world. So mm-hmm. Is it like literally like speaking the Dharma, or is it acting in accordance, you know, like Nyoho, almost like doing your work in accordance with it? I'm just kind of curious what that looks like as far as giving that gift.
Mm-hmm. One of the wonderful things or interesting or frustrating things about Buddhism is that it's been around for 2,600 years, which means that these old lists often get interpreted in many different ways. So in one sense, we can say giving the gift of the Dharma in a literal sense is speaking the words, giving a talk, copying a sutra, like literally sharing that Dharma. But it also becomes embodying the Dharma. So doing your practice in such a way that is beneficial, that is not caught up in any sense of I, me, mine, or I'm doing this and you're doing that, but it is just free and liberated and saturated with Dharma. And by embodying practice in that way, others will see that and go, ah, what is that? There's something there, there's some quality there. And they turn towards the Dharma without having to be preached at, because there is some quality that shows up in your actions that makes people pay attention, that they notice there's something there. That also is a gift to the Dharma. So you can take it either very, very literally or very, very sort of embodied interpretive level. Does that help?
Yeah, it helps a lot, because I don't know that I'm never one for like good for like memorizing like words from a book and then being able to just like spout them, like, well, the Buddha said that, I will never, but I think I have the ability to, I mean, I think I definitely can teach your work at having practice at the ability of being, embodying that more than, yeah, literally preaching it. And
Yeah. If you can be kind, that's the best place to start. And for what it's worth, there's a long-running joke in the YE Sangha about my inability to remember a list of 4 items. I can get through 3 of them and then I get stuck.
That gives me hope. Thank you.
Joshin, thank you so much.
Uh-huh.
I was thinking about this question before your talk, and so your talk goes right to it. But just before Tyler's question, I was what you were saying reminded me of Uchiyama Roshi saying that how we work with the circumstances of our life, how we come forth that way is the Dharma. I think that's what he was saying in so many words. So for me, it's sitting down at my sewing machine. Doesn't even have to be making masks. It could be something else, something for us, something else. But just having things in my hand and something useful to do changes everything. Mm-hmm. It's an experience of complete realization. Anyway, thank you very much.
Yeah, that's giving that gift of attention to the moment at hand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Lovely, thank you. Thank you for sharing that.
I remember feeling, I don't get like this anymore, but I remember in the past feeling very, at times, alone and out of sync with people. Frankly, like childhood karma, nobody likes me. Everybody's off doing their thing and nobody wants to spend any time with me, and it was just a very miserable, miserable place. And at some point I had this, this is what practice does. You're like, I wonder if there's something else I could do besides just stew in my self-pity. And I just thought, I thought about the other lonely people out there. I thought, I wonder if I could reach out to somebody who I think might be lonely. And in doing that, just like you said, it was like, in order to do that, as I did that, my mind had to shift. Mm-hmm. I have attention that can be given. I have a sense of abundance. It was like that act was incompatible with my self-pity. And it's just something that, I've always been able to use to kind of counteract that. So that's what I thought of.
It's just a little bit of magic there, right? Like that discovery of agency can be delightful. I remember you when you were stewing. That's okay. You remember me when I was stewing. Other thoughts or questions?
I'll say one more thing if people aren't too rushing out. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I just loved your part on the importance of a gift of receiving. Mm-hmm. We always think of gifts as giving, and I have this, I grow lots of food and I put it on my corner little stand just with for free, with the option of like by donation. Because mm-hmm. what I realized, I used to do it by free, but people would be coming to my door being like, I would like to give you something. And like yesterday, someone was like, all I have is like this extra can of Pabst Blue Ribbon, but like, I would like you to have this while I'm taking your, you know, your kale. And I don't drink right now, but you know, but it was still mm-hmm. like, and I was like, thank you. Just like taking that. But like, that meant so much to them to be able to give something, right? Mm-hmm. And then what they had was a can of Pabst, and that was but that was important to them because it was their beer, and like, you know, that was what their plan was for the afternoon. So it was, you know, but it struck me when you put that in as a thing, like give the receiving, and I just thought how important that that is in this whole relation to giving.
Yeah. And there's another list in Buddhism somewhere that talks about giving things that are asked for, giving things that you think someone might need, and then giving the gift to the Dharma. So that's another way these can be framed. And it brings up this question of how often do we refrain from giving because we think something might be inappropriate, even if it's asked for, or we give somebody something because we think they might need it, whether or not they ask for it. So that can of paps that you received might be exactly something that somebody else is asking for.
You also made me think of the movie Life is Beautiful.
I don't know that I've seen that one.
Well, if anybody wants to follow up on the theme, I recommend. The father and son end up in a concentration camp. Oh. And the father's gift to the son is to try to make it all seem like a game. I've heard it criticized as being like wildly, you know, unlikely, whatever. But the story of it, you know, in order to preserve his son's innocence and joy, he kind of play acts and does things that make the son, you know, the son doesn't really realize what's going on. And it's like, even in this circumstance, there was something that could be given.
Yeah. Yeah. We're such social creatures that taking care of each other is like one of the greatest joys and one of the biggest sources of pain when that's absent. So that's part of why Sangha is so important.
It also occurs to me that something that we can give right now, well, I can think of a couple things, but one is, I just love that giving the gift of fearlessness. And if you feel any kind of confidence based in practice, to be able to give that sense of even when the shit's hitting the fan and the world's falling apart, if you have any kind of sense of groundedness and equanimity to share with the people around you. And also the embrace of don't know mind. Really notice that with conversations with people that are trying to make sense of stuff and form opinions, and it's the cop's fault and it's this fault and it's that, you know, you're trying to make sense of things and place the blame. And so you know how to handle the craziness that's going on. But part of our practice is also the not having to have all the answers, to be really paying attention and tapped in, but
that's where some of that empathy response comes. You can just be with someone without having to fix or have an answer or change. You can still be uncertain with someone and both be uncertain, and yet somehow it's better because you're not alone in your uncertainty. Somebody's seeing you and you're seeing someone else. Alrighty, how do we wrap this up, Domia?
I'll say a little closing verse.
Yay. Thank you all for listening.
Thank you. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas. Wisdom beyond wisdom. Maha Prajna Paramita.
Thank you, Joe. So much. That was really wonderful.
Thank you.
I loved it. Good to see you.
Thank you, Joe.
See you all later. Be well.
Bye.
Thank you for the splash of sci-fi nerdism in my dharma.
I will.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's hard to leave behind.
In the true tradition of Kyogen, who mentions Star Trek in every other Dharma talk.
Yes, that is true. That is true.
That's how I accepted him as my teacher, because I went into Sanzen. He said, he looked up. You know that episode of Star Trek where the people are on one side? It's like, yes, this is the guy.
Bye-bye, you guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.